Hey, hockey fans. Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Hey guys, it's Allie. Welcome back to Infertile AF, the podcast. This is our fifth anniversary episode, and today I have got a very, very special guest. This is episode 267, called Elizabeth Carr. This episode is brought to you by Fertile. Hey friends, it's Allie. If you're in the middle of your what else can we try family building era, listen up. Fertile is the first and only sterile, FDA-cleared, at-home insemination kit designed for intracervical insemination, so sperm is placed right at the cervical opening. It's engineered to mimic the precision of an IUI, just 1 inch lower, but without washed sperm, meds, or appointments. Fertile is also triple patented, made in the U.S. with IVF-grade materials, and clinically validated. The kit comes with 3 sterile attempts, so you can cover your 3 most fertile days each cycle. It's as easy to use as a tampon, it ships discreetly, and it's HSA, FSA eligible. So who is Fertile for? Folks with unexplained infertility, LGBTQIA plus families, solo parents by choice, or anyone delaying IUI or IVF because of cost or burnout. If you want an option that's private, empowering, and science-backed, this is your sign. Okay, so here's what to do. Go to Fertile.com today and use code INFERTILEAF for $10 off. That's Fertile, pronounced Fertile, but spelled with a PhD out of spite. They told Dr. Jen she wouldn't be a mother, and she used her PhD to prove them wrong. Again, that's PhertilE.com and use code INFERTILEAF. Thanks, Fertile. All right, friends, before we get started, just wanted to remind everybody that my book for children, which is called Work of Art, An IVF Kid Learns About Assisted Reproductive Technology, is out now. It's available on my website, which is infertileafgroup.com, and it is a hardcover book. It is beautiful. I have an amazing illustrator, and it's basically me telling my son, Sonny, how he was born. So it has been out for a little bit and it's getting good reception. I would love for you guys to check it out. So go to the website. It's infertileafgroup.com and check out Work of Art. Okay, so I am so thrilled to have this woman on the show today. She's amazing. Her name is Elizabeth Carr. You probably know her if you are in this world. She was the first person in the United States to be born via in vitro fertilization in 1981. And it was such a big deal when Elizabeth was born that she was followed. There was a press conference when she was 3 days old. So she's been followed her whole life, basically, by the media, who are very interested in everything she's got going on. Today, she is a huge advocate in the infertility world. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to talk about what it was like to grow up as the first baby born via IVF in the US. We're going to talk about her bond with Louise Brown, who is the first baby born ever via IVF. And we're going to talk about all the other things. So it's really interesting. I will note that she and I talked before the Alabama ruling, so we don't get into that a ton. We do talk about reproductive rights and things like that. So if you want to find out what Elizabeth, thinks of that, she does have a website and she's on Instagram. So go check her out there. And she's very vocal about all of that stuff. We talk about the Pope too, and basically how when she was born, he called her a child of the devil. So it's a really great chat. It's a fifth anniversary special. Without further ado, this is Elizabeth's infertility story. Oh my gosh, Elizabeth Carr, I'm so excited to talk to you today. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
You are legendary in the fertility world. everybody should know, if they don't already, that you're the first baby born from in vitro fertilization in the US and the 15th, I believe, in the world. Is that correct?
Something like that.
Okay. So what a cool thing. I just want to start with, how did you find out that this is how you were born? How old were you when your parents told you, or did they tell you? How did you find out?
So that's always such a hard question for me to answer, because I feel like I have always known. And I say that because my birth was so widely publicized that my first press conference was at 3 days old. So clearly, from the very beginning, I knew, you know, I didn't get here like everybody else. But when I was young, you know, around, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, when children start asking the normal questions of where, you know, how did I get here? Where do babies come from?
Right.
Parents, they just kind of said, you know, you came into this world through a lot of science, technology, and with the help of a lot of doctors. And up until a certain point, that, you know, that kind of suffices. But they also had to explain to me at a very young age, because of all the media attention, you know, that I was not born, you know, the way that most of my friends were at that time. But when I was 7, I actually sat down with Doctors Howard and Georgiana Jones, who are responsible for the program that got me here. Yeah. And I watched the NOVA documentary of my birth with them, and they explained the entire process to me then. And so I think,
oh my God,
really around 7 is when I really started to understand.
Yeah. How did that feel to watch that and know that there's even a documentary about this? How cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's bizarre because we watched it, we screened it as a group. So we screened it at one of these Mother's Day reunions that we used to have at the clinic where I was born in Norfolk. Mm-hmm. And so it was a room full of people, all kind of watching me being born. So,
wow,
you know, that's an odd experience as a child to have.
Absolutely. So tell me, what do you know about your parents, Judith and Roger, when they tried to have a baby? Like, can you tell us their story and how they got to the place of doing IVF?
Yeah. So when my parents were married, I mean, they were married young, in their 20s. And my mother was a middle child with an older brother and a younger brother. And my dad was the oldest of 4 children. So they both wanted, you know, fairly large families. And they started trying right away. My mom was a preschool teacher and my dad was an engineer. And they discovered rather quickly, unfortunately, that my mother could get pregnant, but not stay pregnant. Mm-hmm. And she had 3 ectopic pregnancies, which are basically tubal pregnancies, mm-hmm. Right in a row, essentially. And during the last one, it was so bad. The internal bleeding was so bad. And she was so close to death that the doctors basically told her, we are going to remove your fallopian tubes. Mm-hmm. And in the same breath, he also said, and you know that that probably means you will never have children of your own. Mm-hmm. And so while they were kind of processing that and she was recovering from surgery, she went in to have a follow-up checkup just to make sure she was healing okay, all of those good things. And her OBGYN actually tossed her a single page Xerox flyer, essentially, and said, I just came back from this conference where they talked about IVF, which was successful in England. I don't mm-hmm. know, it'd be something you want to consider. There's an experimental program starting in Norfolk. I think you should apply.
And wow.
That was all.
Wow. That's all that. And that like started the trajectory of where they went. That's so cool.
Yeah.
What if that had never happened, you know?
Well, that's why, you know, fast forward to my adult life. That's why I'm so passionate about advocacy and people understanding all of the different reproductive technologies out there, not just IVF, but mm-hmm. everything that's on the table and available, because I just think that, you know, what if that doctor had never shared that option that he learned about with my parents.
Right.
Like, I would not be here if somebody didn't tell them, because these options were not being talked about, you know, by their friends, neighbors, in the media, et cetera. So they never would have had an opportunity to learn about it if it weren't for that one, you know, flyer that basically said not a heck of a lot much on it.
Right. So, absolutely. I mean, and this was like, so you were born in 1981. So this was, you know, was this, you know, the 80, like early 80s or late 70s, even when they were starting to try?
Yeah. It was like 79.
Okay. So this was groundbreaking, very little known about this, you know, not very talked about, like you said. And I have to say, you know, that's what you and I can bond over, is just the passion of advocacy and talking about this. And, you know, we can get into that a little bit more in what you're doing now, which is so interesting. But back to Judith and Roger, your parents. So what was their, did they tell you, what was their reaction to that? Were they like, let's go for it? Or were they trepidatious or, you know, hesitant?
Yeah. So they've both said at various times that, like, it's kind of a blessing that they didn't know what they didn't know. Mm-hmm. Because they viewed it as like, well, what the heck do we have to lose? Mm-hmm. Truthfully, like, if it doesn't work, then we're just back to where we currently are.
Right.
So they felt like we might as well take a shot. Now, it gets a little complicated, though, to take that shot, because you have to think about the landscape. So in the 80s, first of all, there was absolutely zero insurance coverage for IVF and any kind of reproductive technologies.
Right.
Secondly, my parents lived in Massachusetts, but this program and this clinic was in Norfolk, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were flying back and forth for blood draws. She was the first woman to go through a hormone protocol.
Wow.
Because IVF in the UK, when Louise was born, who was the first in the world, mm-hmm. that was all natural cycle. There was not a hormone protocol for that. So, like, they were doing hormone protocols, they were doing blood draws, they were doing, you know, she'd had to fly down there for an ultrasound. So mm-hmm. it wasn't like outpatient, and she didn't give herself hormone shots. Like, they were administered by the team of doctors down there. So you think about, you know, the expense and just physical exhaustion that goes along with the travel,
right,
that's involved in that. And it, you know, it's mind boggling.
Right. And also that there's no guarantee, you know, this is so experimental and pioneering at the time. Right. Have your mom and dad told you, you know, after all of this, like, what it was like on their, you know, emotional state and mental state and all that?
Yeah. I mean, they didn't really let them get themselves get excited, you know, mm-hmm. when they found out that she was indeed pregnant. They also found out in the same breath, like, oh, by the way, you're also our first success, because there had been 41 failed attempts before my parents, in this particular program.
Okay. So was it the first attempt for your parents, like the first cycle that did work?
Yeah. So that's the other thing. Everybody thinks, like, in modern terms of IVF, there weren't even cycles back then. It was gotcha. Like, you get one shot and that's it. You okay. know?
Totally.
Because they didn't know how to, like, cycle for multiple rounds of hormones and triggers and all these kinds of, and everything was fresh. There was, remember, we didn't even know how to freeze embryos back
then. Right.
So, like, this is very, it seems almost medieval, you know, compared to where we are now. Yeah.
Isn't it wild that this is only, you know, you're 42 years old. Like,
yeah,
that so much has changed in, you know, just these four decades.
I know.
And
I
then
know.
It, you think, what's going to happen in the next four, you know?
It's amazing to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. So, okay. So did they, your mom, you know, she went through this, they're flying back and forth. What did they think when they found out that they were pregnant? Were they, I'm sure they were nervous and, you know, not sure, right?
Yeah, they were cautiously optimistic, but also, you know, they had to make the decision in the same vein of dealing with, okay, we're pregnant. Is it going to, are we, am I going to stay pregnant? Are we going to stay pregnant? they also had to make the decision at that time, because they were the first, whether or not they would share their story and their names and everything else with the press, mm-hmm. which adds a whole other level of stress and pressure to the scenario. Right. And, you know, the doctors, Jones, sat my parents down and said, well, you do have the option. If you want to stay private, we can shield you as best we can, and not release any information about you to the general public. But they felt very strongly that people should know about this option. And if it worked, that people should see that, you know, they were just a normal couple and I was a normal baby who looked and acted and sounded like everybody else. Because that was a big fear back then. People thought, you know, perhaps IVF would mean that I would come out with like a deformity or mm-hmm. something wrong with me. And so they felt very strongly that, like, no, people should see Elizabeth and see that she's just like a normal baby.
That's so amazing that they were like some of the first advocates for this. And, you know, like, you're carrying on that tradition with talking about this and spreading the word, which is awesome. There probably wasn't, I mean, I'm sure there wasn't like genetic testing or anything at the time, right?
No. And that's, so not only was there not genetic testing, there was also not, you know, embryo grades were not really a thing. That kind of all came about, you know, because of and after my birth, as well as, you know, just the fact that, again, like, we couldn't freeze embryos. They were mm-hmm. fresh. Mm-hmm. There's so much technology that came out of my birth that mm-hmm. that's also crazy to think about. Even small things that, like, you know, the science nerd in me gets really excited about, like, everybody was making their old culture mediums, where now, as you have these big biotech companies that make the mediums for the petri dishes and things like that. But no, they were really worried. And actually, there was a statement that nobody has ever read that my doctor had prepared about what a sad day it was because it didn't work or whatever, because the ultrasound, think about ultrasound. Ultrasound in the 80s was also still not where it is today. It was terrible.
Right.
If you know me in real life, I'm short. I'm only 5 feet tall. Mm-hmm. So I was a peanut. When I came out, I was only 5 pounds, 12 ounces. So right. They were really worried that I was going to have some kind of deformity or, you know, something terribly wrong with me.
Uh-huh. Okay. So what else did your mom go through, like, what we call today, like, the egg retrieval process? Like, was that super different than it is now? Or, like, what do you know about that?
Yeah. So she did go through a retrieval, and the retrieval process is basically the same. You know, she tells the horror story of, like, she has the smallest bladder of anybody I know. And so mm-hmm. like, have a full bladder was, like, extremely painful for her. And, you know, flying on top of that and everything else, like, just, you know, all the things involved with that.
Right.
The transfer itself, you know, it was not ultrasound guided, which most of them are now. And they also, this is so crazy to think that this is how they did it back then, but this is the truth. In order to actually transfer the embryo, they would blow into a very long pipette catheter and blow the egg into the uterus.
Oh my God. Wow.
And that is how it would get there.
Wow. So the doctors, Jones, were they the ones that were doing the blowing? Like, how many people are on the medical team? Yeah. Like, how many people were in the room?
I don't know how many people were in the room, but it was a fairly big team.
Yeah.
Doctors Howard and Georgiana, Dr. Garcia, Dr. Annabelle Acosta. Like, I know all of them.
Oh my God. And this must have been so exciting for everybody.
Yeah. And then you just hope it sticks. Right. So she tells the story of, you know, we don't do this now, but they made her lay completely still after the transfer for, like, some ridiculous amount of time. And she just remembers her legs being up in the air and all the pressure was on her neck.
Oh, so, wow. Yes.
Like, oh, I said, practically medieval at this point.
Absolutely. It's so wild. So then how was the pregnancy?
You know, as pregnancies go, I mean, it was pretty easy. She didn't have morning sickness. She didn't have any of those things. But, you know, just the traveling back and forth for all the checkups and things like that. Like, she didn't really, you know, most people now graduate back to their OBGYN. Mm-hmm. That was not the case with my mother. Like, they stayed with the fertility clinic, and there was an OBGYN on staff at the fertility clinic as well. Mm-hmm. Her entire infertility team was still, you know, with her every step of the day of the way. And actually, on the day I was born, it was the surgeon, the doctors Jones, the OBGYN, Dr. Mason Andrews, plus my father and an entire Nova documentary crew. So it was a very packed delivery room. And I was delivered by C-section because, again, I was so small that they were worried.
But
crazy times.
That's so cool that they had the foresight to do the documentary, too. You know, that they were going to cover all this for just from a journalistic standpoint and from a historical standpoint, too. Like, how awesome to get all that footage and to get, you know, to cover such a groundbreaking thing.
Yeah. And if anybody wants to watch it or is a total nerd like me,
100%.
You can watch it online. There are ways you can watch it online, but it was by Nova.
Yeah.
It's called A Daughter for Judy.
Oh, I love that. So, okay. So then you were born and it was probably this media storm and just amazing. You know, everyone was probably so thrilled, and I bet the medical team, everybody's celebrating. What do you remember about, like, growing up? Like, was it always a big deal on, like, your first birthday, your second birthday? Like, did the media stay with you, like, as you grew up? And was this always something that was just a big part of your life?
Yeah, I will say the media attention still has not stopped.
That's wild.
We just had the Pope come out with remarks about surrogacy, right? And so the phone was ringing off the hook that day.
Right.
Reporters looking for comment.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. So
do you care to share your comments on that? I'd love to hear what you think.
My take is that, you know, the Pope, when I was born, called me a child of the devil. So, like, the stance itself was not shocking to me, even though it was incredibly disappointing.
Wow.
But so that's just kind of how, you know, I understand that, you know, their view is not one that I share. But
yes.
But yeah, I mean, I've basically always had the media attention. So, like I said, like, nobody really knew, was I going to come out okay? And the long-term effects. So, for example, when I got pregnant with my son, which, by the way, like, everybody, you know, it's, everybody asks me, no, I did not have to have any reproductive interventions. I had him, you know, the good old fashioned way.
Okay.
But that was a question, you know, is she going to have IVF because she was an IVF baby? Like, is everything still functioning properly with her, you know, organs and all of those things? So.
Mm-hmm. Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays, decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa, got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments, Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels, Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Yeah, it's just been kind of a constant presence in my life.
What about at the time? So again, you were born in 1981. The terminology back then was different too. Were they still using the term like test tube baby and things like that? And were there other terms now that are so outdated?
Yeah, the two that I absolutely despise, and unfortunately, I've been trying to kill them for ever, but they still sometimes persist, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So test tube baby is obviously the one that's like the slang for an IVF baby. And I hate that, especially because
let's kill that right now.
No, it's test tube used even. So, but Petri dish baby, I guess, doesn't sound exciting.
And then the other one that still to this day has stuck around is Designer Baby. Mm. Like, and that just like, it's, you know, those phrases are like nails on a chalkboard for
Absolutely.
Me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Tell me why that really bothers you so much from your opinion. I mean, I get it, but I'd love to hear in your own words.
I mean, you know, the only, especially with the way I was born,
right?
The only difference is that fertilization occurred in a petri dish. That's it. That's the whole total sum of the difference in how I was born. It was still, you know, my mother's egg and my father's sperm, and then it was fertilization in a petri dish. And then, as to quote my doctor when I was, you know, 7 years old, and then you were put back in your mother's womb just like everybody else.
Right.
So, you know, this idea of picking and choosing, like there was, especially when I was born, there was absolutely none of that. Like my parents barely could tell my sex because the ultrasound was so poor. So, you know, just that concept of piecing together, you know, your ideal, whatever, it's
right. They make it seem like it's a choice and it's for the privileged and it's, you know, something that people want to do. And, you know, like that was, it just gives a negative connotation to it, I think. And it doesn't represent at all what happened with you or with most people, right. You know? Okay. So let's talk about as you got older, like you said, you had your son without assisted, you know, reproductive technology. And then now you work in the industry, basically. So tell everybody what you do. It's so interesting.
Yeah. So I am head of advocacy, patient advocacy, I should say, public relations and marketing for a company called Genomic Prediction, which produces the LifeView pre-implantation genetic testing suite. So it's not lost on me that like now I get to work at a place where this technology was not even available when I was born.
Right.
And can really help, you know, improve the chance of pregnancy, because we can identify things that we couldn't identify back then, like chromosomal abnormalities. When they looked at my mother's embryos under a microscope, of which, by the way, when you think about retrievals now, her retrieval, they only got two embryos.
Okay.
And one was more round than the other. And that is the one they chose to transfer, which is like, you know, also mind boggling. Like now we have the ability to see, like, does this embryo actually contain all the genetic material that it should?
Right.
To, you know, get to that blastocyst stage.
Right.
And we can even go as far as identifying the risk for diseases, whether or not they're in your family history that you may or may not know about, which is also fascinating. Like we can look for what's your risk for heart disease, schizophrenia, diabetes, all these kinds of things that were absolutely, I don't think anybody could have imagined we could do that back when I was.
Absolutely. So you called yourself earlier a science nerd and it, you know, it kind of begs the question. I love that, by the way, but were you always into science or do you think it's because of the way that you were born that you naturally had like this predisposition towards the field? Because it was kind of just a big part of your life anyway.
So I will say I think because of how I was born, I was more open-minded to learning about all of these kinds of things. Now, I am not good at science or math. And so I'm really interested in the science, but I come at it from, you know, more like a communications standpoint. I actually, for most of my career, was a reporter and I worked at the Boston Globe for many years since I was 18 till I was in my late 30s.
That's awesome. And
I was writing about health and wellness, shocker, I'm sure, to nobody. So
it's like, write what you know, right?
Yeah. I mean, so I've always kind of enjoyed this idea of taking complex things that are hard to understand and breaking them down and making them very simple. Because like, think about, and I think that principle kind of stems from Dr. Georgiana telling me that sentence of like, you know, IVF is when the sperm and the egg are fertilized in a petri dish and then transferred back to the mother's womb. And 9 months later, you're born just like everybody else. Like that's it sounds very simple when you say it that way, right?
Right. Absolutely.
I think I've always kind of had that bent of like, I want people to be able to understand these really complex things in language like that. that is accessible and easy to understand and not intimidating.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, as a journalist myself as well, I think that's one of the things I learned in journalism school was like explaining things to people almost as if you're talking to a friend, you know, like that's part of the skill I think of journalists is to break stuff down that's complicated and make it palatable for people that aren't in that field or, you know, going down that wormhole, you know? So I think that's exactly right. And it sounds like, you know, you're obviously really good at your job for a reason.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I think it's just fascinating, you know, just all of the different options that are out there now. And so if we don't present the options in language that is not intimidating, people will be too scared to learn about all the different things out there.
Yeah. Well, I think so, I told you, so I wrote this book, this children's book called Work of Art, and IVF Kid Learns About Assisted Reproductive Technology. And it's the story of me telling my son how he was born. And that was the exact reason that I wanted to do it was because, you know, I feel like it's a springboard for parents who want to talk to their kids about it. You know, it's like an entree. It's a way for the conversation to get going. Cause I'm with you and thinking that we need to normalize these conversations. We need to make them not scary. We need to make them, you know, understood by everybody, because I still think there's a lot of people that don't really know what IVF and assisted reproductive technology and all this stuff is. Would you agree?
Yeah, they don't. They 1000% don't. And I've always said my goal is for people to know their options before they even get an infertility diagnosis.
Right.
Like the worst time to learn about your options is when you have gotten that diagnosis and you feel like you're in a moment of crisis.
Absolutely.
As opposed to like learning about them on the front end and then getting the diagnosis and then, you know, it's still going to be terribly hard to deal with, but at least you're operating from a place of like, okay, let's investigate all these different options and find out which one would be the best fit for us instead of saying, oh my gosh, I don't even know what to do or where to start. But it's funny too, because when I was about 10, I was in a classroom at school and they broke the classroom apart. So the boys were on one side of the hall and the girls were on the other. And it was the day of, you know, the sex talk, essentially. Right. And they played a video on like, you know, the birds and the bees and how babies are made. And the school nurse, I'll never forget this. The school nurse looked around the room of girls and said, are there any questions? And I raised my hand and I was like, well, that might be how some people were born, but that is not exactly how I got here. And let me explain to you how I got here.
Amazing. I love that you did that. How old were you?
I was 10.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Because I felt like, now, wait a minute.
Yeah.
That doesn't represent.
That's not the whole story. Yeah.
Now, granted, my poor parents got a phone call and nasty letter home that like the information I shared was not a part of the approved curriculum and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But by the same token, like I understood from a very young age of like, well, what if somebody else in this classroom or their brother or sister or cousin was born the way I was born? Are they going to feel like it wasn't a valid way to be here?
Right.
That was kind of what I was thinking. That's why I was like, nope, that's not how I got here. Let me tell you how I got here.
That's so cool. What was the reaction from your fellow like classmates?
Some of them had already known because of all the media attention, but didn't necessarily understand. And then the other ones, it was kind of like not a big deal because I never made it a big deal.
Right.
Like just how I got here.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about too, with normalizing this, you know, like my daughter was not born through IVF and my son was, but they're both like, it's just normal for both of them. You know, it's just part of life. So I think it's cool that the more we talk about this, and I love that you did that at age 10, how badass. So cool. So, okay. Tell me a little bit more about what you're doing now in terms of, you know, advocating and, you know, we talked a little bit just now about sex education that you got. You know, that's a theme on this podcast is like most people didn't get good sex education, including myself. And that's why I found myself in this infertility situation in my late 30s, not knowing I couldn't have a baby at any time in my life. You know, I had secondary infertility and I was like, what is going on? I've never even heard of that. Right. So what, you know, what are you doing in terms of, you know, helping, you know, with sex education and advocating for, you know, the women that are coming after us and men?
So On the advocacy front, shameless plug for Resolve. I participate every year in their Federal Advocacy Day. And if you haven't signed up yet, please do so because it's critically important. So I have collaborated with Resolve for many, many years and, you know, have been on the front lines of some of the people testifying in front of these state legislatures or, you know, a bunch of representatives for insurance coverage and mandates, because that, you know, to me is such, it's such a barrier for most people that it's one that I feel like we can eventually remove. We just have to stay on it and be like a dog on a bone. Interesting story. A reason I am so passionate about that particular niche of advocacy is, rewind, remember, I was born in Norfolk, Virginia. Guess what state does not have an insurance mandate to cover IVF?
Wow. Let me guess.
Virginia.
Yeah.
So I, for the past several years, unfortunately, have been in front of the Virginia, Commonwealth of Virginia legislatures talking about why we need this insurance mandate in the Commonwealth of Virginia, which we still don't have, even though they had the first IVF baby in the country.
That's wild. That's wild.
So we're still not there in a lot of states. We're not there. And we, that's another piece of the awareness and advocacy puzzle that I think people neglect to think about. So, for example, when I have friends that figure out that they need reproductive technologies to get pregnant, and, you know, many times people talk to me over the internet and on my Instagram and things like that, the first question I ask is, what state are you in right now? Because you need to figure out if you live in a mandate state or not. And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, that means you may not have coverage and you may have to pay out of pocket for all of this.
Right.
And that is something you should know upfront.
Absolutely.
And be very aware of, so you can plan for your different options.
So did you say with your parents, did they end up paying out of pocket for everything? I mean, obviously there wasn't insurance at the time, but I don't know if it was part of a program where they didn't have to pay themselves.
No, my dad always jokes it was like buying a brand new Ferrari for the first 10 years of my life every year.
I love that.
It was a very expensive investment. Yeah.
Yes, of course. That's incredible. That's incredible. So tell us a little bit more about, you know, just people who maybe don't know anything about advocating, you know, don't know much about what you're doing, working at Genomic Prediction. You know, what are some things that you'd love to share with people that are kind of new to this world, just about things that you've learned, like since you've been in this world, and things that you're working to change and improve?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing, especially about advocacy, I think people find the concept a little bit intimidating because they feel like they have to be the expert. But the reality of the situation is you don't have to be an expert. You just have to have passion and a willingness to like roll up your sleeves and and contribute to the conversation. And so again, shameless plug for Resolve, but you can sign up for their Resolve Advocacy Network in like literally 2 seconds on your phone, on your website, and they will do call outs of like very specific things that you can do to help that are very not intimidating. So maybe it's, you know, fill out this letter and send it, or help us make phone calls, or sign up for Federal Advocacy Day. Like, you do not have to be an expert in order to be an active participant in advocacy. So I would say thing number one to know is like, don't be intimidated, because we've all been there, but I can speak from experience. You don't have to be an expert. You don't have to have a story like mine in order to help. Secondly, the other thing, and I think this also comes from like my journalistic background, is there are no dumb questions. None. None whatsoever. If you have a question about anything, whether it's process, technology, access to care, benefits, anything, somebody else out there has the same exact question.
Yeah. I love that.
Guaranteed. And so that's part of like my job when I was a journalist, was to ask the questions that everybody had on their mind that everybody was too scared to ask.
Mm-hmm.
And so don't be afraid to ask a question, even if you think it might be dumb, because, you know, sometimes
Dr. Google is not the answer, you know.
Exactly.
I'll never forget, my son's pediatrician told me when I was a new mom, he was like, just remember, Google isn't caring for a baby.
I love that. That's so true.
You know, so that's, you know, thing number two, I think, is really just don't be afraid to ask the questions.
Right.
And then for me, number three is really just taking a little bit of solace. If you are going through an infertility journey or wherever you are on your family building path, just knowing that you aren't alone, I think, is so critical, because it can be very lonely. And you don't necessarily have to share your story with anybody, or if you're not comfortable doing that or anything like that. But just knowing that on any given day, you know, one in six people experience infertility. And so, like, clearly, sadly, you are not in this room alone.
Right.
And I think it's so important to remember that, because, you know, back when I was born, nobody was talking about it. And we, you know, people really truly were on these journeys alone. Now, at least, there are resources and incredible things people can access.
Yep.
To have a better understanding. But, and so, like, I'm really proud we've come that far since I was born.
Yeah. What are some of the other things that you've seen happen in the last 40 years since you were born, just in terms of the technology and in terms of the infertility world and communities? Like, is there anything that exists now that you're like, wow, we've come a long way?
I mean, there's so many milestones that I have watched and I've had a front seat to. One I vividly remember, and now it's just really being talked about in the mainstream, even though it's been around for a while, which is egg freezing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember touring a facility when I was in my teens where they had just successfully frozen eggs and embryos. And it was part of a program for fertility preservation for cancer patients. Mm-hmm. That's how it started. And now it's so mainstream. People are talking about it everywhere.
Yeah.
Really understanding it's an option for fertility preservation up front, and even egg donation, things like that. I mean, there's just been so much that I've seen. You know, people often say, like, oh, the field of IVF hasn't changed that much. And I'm like, well, in some ways it has, and in some ways it hasn't. I think, you know, the technology that we have available now, like I said, with like the pre-implantation genetic testing and things mm-hmm. like that, it's incredible, and it really can be game changing for people. I mean, mm-hmm. just to know that out of, you know, XYZ amount of embryos, you know, you have three that are euploid that you could potentially transfer, and
yes.
and that they're valid and viable. You know,
yeah.
It's incredible just to think about all of the transformations we've seen.
That's exactly what happened to me. Was I had five embryos sent for testing, and only one of them was healthy. And that was the one we transferred who became my son. So,
yeah,
you know, had we not had that technology, you know, I could have had four more miscarriages on top of my other four, you know, so it's pretty amazing. I just got the chills talking about it, even, because I still, like, can't believe it. It blows my mind that this exists.
Yeah. And people, again, like, it's something that not a lot of people, like, I feel like the pre-implantation genetic testing field is kind of where egg freezing was like 10 or 15 years ago, where it was available and around, but people weren't talking about it in a widespread way because yeah. it seems very complex. But the truth of the matter is it just will help you have a better outcome.
Right.
Will increase your chances of pregnancy. That if you know nothing else about pre-implantation genetic testing and all the different specific tests, that's the one thing you should really hone in on, is that it can really reduce your miscarriage and improve your chances of pregnancy.
Absolutely. So you mentioned earlier Louise Brown, who's the first English woman who was born via IVF. I'm assuming you guys have met. Have you guys bonded over, you know, being the firsts?
Yeah, she's actually a very good friend of mine.
I love that.
And yeah, we have this funny bond because nobody else in the world essentially can understand kind of the various unique and different experiences we've been through. I mean, you know, we often compared notes about, like, just all the ridiculous questions we've been asked over the years.
Like, do you feel special? Do you feel normal? It's like, mm-hmm. well, my entire life. Like, what do you want me to say? Like, right. I don't feel different. So that's a terrible question.
Right.
Or like one I often get that she's gotten to is like, do you have a belly button?
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
Because people think like if I was born in a tube, but which I wasn't, you know, I mean, just kind of things like that. So yeah, she's a dear, dear friend. And so we have this kind of inside language that I think nobody else really understands.
That is so cool. So I can't thank you enough for, first of all, talking about all this stuff and just for the work that you're doing and the advocacy and the continuing education and normalizing all this stuff. You know, I feel super honored, honestly, to talk to you. Thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. It's so great to have platforms like yours where people can, you know, learn and listen and understand about these things. Cause like I said, you know, back in the day, there were so few of us talking about all of this that it's really nice. So much more mainstream now.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to my 5th anniversary episode. I can't believe it's been 5 years. It feels like it has absolutely flown by. 267 episodes, some of the most amazing people I've ever spoken to in my entire life. So thank you guys for listening. And check out my Instagram for some fun 5th anniversary events and giveaways. Thanks again to Elizabeth Carr for being my guest today. And thank you guys, as always, for an amazing 5 years. And I feel like we're just getting started.
This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like JoJo, who's learning simple, healthy habits, Sharia, who's making progress with meds, and Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.